Welcome to Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors. I'm your host, Chris McGregor, and I am delighted to be joined by Mark Brumley. Mark is the president and CEO of Ignatius Press. Never before in history has a Pope answered a journalist's wide-ranging, personal, and controversial questions in a direct, one-on-one, book-length series of interviews. But for 6 days, in July of 2010, Pope Benedict XVI did just that with journalist Peter Seewald. The result is a no-holds-barred, 239-page book of candid, explicit, and often surprising questions and answers. With Mark Brumley, we're going inside the pages of Light of the World, The Pope, the Church, and the Signs of the Times, published by Ignatius Press. Welcome, Mark.
It's great to be with you, Chris.
Mark, Light of the World, The Pope, the Church, and Signs of the Times, a conversation with Peter Seewald, an extraordinary book. The interviewer, Peter Seewald, is German, is he not?
Yes.
So that made it easier for the Holy Father to be able to have this conversation with a fellow German.
Well, I think it's true. I mean, I think there are at least two things that made it easier for the Holy Father to decide, hey, yeah, this is something to do. I mean, apart from the fact that we live in a much more media-dominant age and people see the value of having access, you know, in sort of one-on-one interviews with prominent people, that's sort of lurking in the background. But I think there are two other factors. One, as you mentioned, the fact that this was an interview conducted in German by a German journalist, German-speaking journalist. So I'm sure the Holy Father felt much more comfortable talking about some of these more controversial and contemporary issues than he would if he were doing another language, even though, you know, he's very fluent in many languages. But the second thing is that this particular journalist was someone that he had a history with. He had done two other interview books with Peter Seewald. He did those when he was just Cardinal Ratzinger. But, you know, he had a very positive experience in Salt of the Earth and Light of the World. In fact, Salt of the Earth was a book that was done that actually helped bring Peter Seewald back to the faith. You know, he was sort of fallen away and was an agnostic, a skeptic. And the interview that he did with then-Cardinal Ratzinger brought him back to the Catholic faith. So there was that backstory of having been interviewed by this German journalist before and having had such a good relationship, strong rapport with Peter Seewald, that I think was part of the reason why the Holy Father agreed to do this Light of the World interview.
I was so stunned just in the very first chapter when the question of his prayer life came up. Peter Seewald posed an interesting question about his mystical experience, essentially, or what was his prayer like as opposed to how John Paul prayed?
Well, I think the Holy Father sees John Paul as very mystical in his style of prayer, and I think that's evident when you see recordings of John Paul. Sometimes he seems, you know, almost caught up in a kind of deep mystical experience, and I think that was characteristic of the man. Benedict is pretty honest that, you know, his prayer is much more, you know, sort of ordinary, like the rest of us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in fact, he says, you know, I'm no mystic. But at the same time, I think he sees the experience and the burden of the papal office as something that has deepened his prayer life, because he becomes much more aware of his dependence on God. I mean, obviously, we're all dependent on God for everything that we do. It comes down to a question of how aware are we of that dependence, and being thrust into an office like the papacy. Not that his office is the prefect for the, you know, Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith. The office he had before he was pope was an insignificant office, but, you know, there's a, you know, several magnitudes of difference, or, you know, when you come into the office of the papacy. And so obviously he said that, you know, that has had a tremendous experience on him.
Speaking of seeing the real man, we really have seen him so clearly in how he's handled the abuse scandal, which, Mark, I thought that we in the United States were past this point of the true trauma of the scandal, or maybe coming on the downward curve. But events in Philadelphia recently have kind of brought it to the fore again that this is something that has really rocked the church. And the Holy Father is very aware of this and is trying his best to respond.
Absolutely. One of the things in the book, he's asked the question, can you understand why people respond by leaving in protest, by leaving the church in protest? And his response is, I can understand it. I'm thinking, of course, above all, about the victims themselves. It is difficult for them to keep believing that the church is a source of good, that she communicates the light of Christ, that she helps people in life. I can understand that. And others who have only these negative perceptions no longer see then the overall picture, the life of the church. All the more reason that the church must strive to make this vitality and this greatness visible again, despite all that is negative. So he understands how people react. They hear these things, they see these stories, maybe they've been victimized themselves, and so on. He's aware of that, and he's sensitive to that. He's also very firm, I think, in what he says about abuse and how it's been covered up in some instances. In fact, I think he uses an expression, something like, a volcano of filth. Mm-hmm. This evil has been in the church. So it's not as if this is something that he hasn't grappled with and he hasn't struggled with.
He responds to the case of Father Maciel and says that anything involving lies and concealment should not be. Not just in that case, but in any case within the structure of the church.
Absolutely. I mean, the church is, the mission of the church is to proclaim the truth. And so therefore, the credibility of the church is undermined when her senior pastors, the bishops, are seen to be lying or are concealing the truth. And it's hurt the mission of the church. I reflect on this a lot, and I study the history of the church. And people who don't believe in the devil are naive or foolish, because mm-hmm. you can see a diabolical intelligence in at work in the history of the church. And this is certainly the case in the abuse scandal. Certainly, there's diabolical activity in the act of abuse. A priest abusing other people, especially children, is in itself diabolical. But when you look at the broader picture and you think, well, we're living in an age that desperately needs the truth of Christ, desperately needs the teaching of the church on human sexuality, on marriage, on the gospel of life, and all of these things. And that desperate need is the church's ability to respond to that desperate need has been undercut by the abuse scandal. So, I mean, you can just see the diabolical intellect at work there in undermining the credibility of the church, so that when bishops and priests stand up and proclaim the truth, they can't be taken seriously because of the scandal. Or in many instances, bishops or priests feel as if they shouldn't say anything because their credibility has been undermined, and therefore they don't say anything. In some instances, obviously, I don't want to paint a broad brush, because there are many, many bishops and many priests, who are credible and who are speaking the truth and so on. But you can see how this has just been a terrible thing, both obviously for the victims themselves, and for the credibility of the church and the church's message. I mentioned a third victim, and that is all the innocent priests, the mm-hmm. priests who are good and faithful and holy men, who find their ministry undercut, called into question. Many of them say, they go out in public in their clerical attire, and they feel like people are thinking ill of them or thinking they're child molesters or whatever. And this is because of the horrible thing that so many, that the priests, it's a small minority of priests, of course, but those priests have given all priests a bad name in many contexts.
Another area where he really encourages us through his example, but also in his promptings with his words, is to have the courage to speak truth with a capital T.
Absolutely. You know, people are not, again, we're going back to this theme, but it's an important one. Paul VI, in his apostolic exhortation, Evangelii Nuntiandi, which was on evangelization, said that one of the challenges of today, he wasn't necessarily being critical of it, he was just observing, one of the challenges of today is that people are more willing to listen to witnesses than they are to teachers. That there's a kind of skepticism about authority figures that people have. But where there's a question of personal witness, when one can say that this is not just something somebody told me, but this is a reality that I know from my own experience, that people are far more open and willing to talk to or to listen to what people have to say. And obviously this relates to the clergy sexual abuse scandal, because precisely one of the things that's been undermined is the ability of people in ordained ministry, and bishops and priests, to witness because their credibility has been hurt by the sexual abuse scandal. But also there is a kind of a radical calling into question, going even beyond what Paul VI was talking about in the 70s. There is a radical relativism, which in a kind of very confused way is willing to concede a measure of truth, but it's been so relativized as to be, you know, largely irrelevant. So I can believe, well, you know, Chris, you have your truth, mm-hmm. and I have my truth, and if it works for you, great, but you know what, you really can't impose your truth on me, and therefore, you know, the whole idea of personal witness gets undermined, you know, because I can give you a personal witness about what Jesus Christ means to me, what the Catholic faith means to me, and you can, in this radical dictatorship of relativism, you can feel perfectly fine with that and say, well, that's great for you, but that has no claim on me. I don't need to consider the truth of what you're saying because I have my own story. Mm-hmm. And my own story doesn't necessarily connect with yours, and I can just simply live my life and sort of create my own way of looking at the world. And I really am not accountable to you or to anybody, to anything outside of myself for how I live my life and how I view the world. So you can see how the Holy Father would see this, what he calls dictatorship of relativism, as being very, very significant and a real challenge. The dictatorship quality, the idea there is that it is required, as in a dictatorship, that I cannot make claims to the truth that transcend my own particular story. I can't, if I say to you, well, no, there is a God, and there's a God who made the world, and a God who is present and active in the world, and a God to whom we are ultimately one day all going to be accountable for the choices that we've made and the actions that we've taken. If I say that to you, the dictatorship of relativism says, no, you're not allowed to say that. You're not allowed to make that claim. You're only allowed to make claims for what is true for you and what is meaningful for you. But once you go beyond that and you talk in a way as to suggest that this is true for everybody, that's not allowed. And the dictatorship of relativism will come down on you and will say, you're imposing your views on me. You're dogmatic. You're not allowed to do that. And in some instances, even on the point whether we're talking about educational institutions or civil institutions, there's a point of things being legislated and this relativism being imposed on society.
It's ironic, isn't it? That imposition of thought is more crushing in expression than what they are claiming that those who want to verbalize, who feel called to verbalize truth, I mean, their imposition is less freedom and more crushing. It's just so ironic.
It's a dictatorship in the name of freedom.
Right, right.
People are free to express themselves, but they're not free to express themselves in such a way that may lead other people to have to, you know, challenge other people to reconsider their own views. And instead of seeing this as, you know, to use the expression, maybe the overused expression, the marketplace of ideas, there is a kind of, to use an analogy, there's a kind of statist outlook. We're not going to have a free marketplace of ideas where, you know, we can present the truth, even a truth that we would claim that would have universal application, and, you know, let's see how that plays out in the marketplace of ideas. No, we're going to have a kind of statist or socialistic understanding of the of ideas, and we're going to have this dominant relativism forced on us.
The chapter in particular on ecumenism and the dialogue with Islam, I when you talk about the dictatorship of relativism and you talk about having the courage to speak truth, in this particular dialogue, again, with ecumenism, with other faiths, but also with Islam, he really has shown extraordinary courage, hasn't he?
Yes, he has. I mean, I think in a lot of ways, Benedict is, I mean, those are two different things, ecumenism and Islam, because ecumenism, strictly speaking, is a conversation that takes place among Christians. It's not, we're talking about people who profess faith in Christ and in that sense have an allegiance that is a Christian allegiance, and they participate in varying degrees and varying ways in communion with the Catholic Church. It's a real but imperfect communion with the Catholic Church, because there is real communion with other Christians in Christ. When we're talking about Islam, we're discussing really interreligious conversation, interreligious dialogue, a conversation between people whose starting point is much further apart, or starting points, I should say, are much further apart than the relationship between Christians. Now, Islam is very difficult, very difficult. I think the Pope is a moderate, or what might be a way of putting it, a mitigated optimist. I think he thinks that there's a segment of Islam that can be reached and that a dialogue can take place, but there is also an area, a huge aspect of Islam that really has cut itself off from conversation. He refers to that when he talks about where Islam is a kind of monocultural, where there's a monocultural dominance, where Islam is calling all the shots, and Christianity or other religions are in a very, very minority position. And in a certain sense, that's where the real test of a religious worldview is. You know, when you have all the power and can call all the shots, how do you respond to other groups within that society? And there, I think the Holy Father is far more pessimistic, if we're going to use that word, in, you know, some kind of dialogue, some kind of conversation. So it's very difficult. It's a very difficult issue, especially the issue of religious freedom, because Christians are in many Islamic societies persecuted. Uh-huh. Catholics are persecuted. And yet we hear from Islam, many of the leaders of Islam, you know, they want the ability to expand Islam into the Western cultures, and they feel like the protections of religious freedom in the West are things that they should have claim to. And yet we don't see a reciprocity in the Islamic world.
Mm-hmm.
And really it needs to be the case that if we have these westernized Muslim leaders who are calling for religious freedom, they're claiming, calling for is a bad way of putting it, if they are making use of and exploiting the religious freedom of the West to practice Islam, then it behooves them. They, in fact, they're obliged to recognize that in Islamic countries, Christians and many others don't have the same kind of religious freedom that they have, that these Muslim populations in the West have, and that they should be calling upon their brother Muslims to extend that kind of freedom. This is actually not a theme that is unique to Pope Benedict. It is something that goes back to John Paul II, who was, by the way, in many ways much more, accommodating towards Islam than Benedict has been. You know, of course, Benedict's mm-hmm. pontificate comes post 9/11, mm-hmm. and there's much more of a sense that there are very active and dangerous extreme wings in Islam today, not simply the Islam of dialogue. It's a very complex and diverse phenomenon. And but John Paul II himself, underscored the absolute necessity of this kind of reciprocity when it comes to religious freedom in the Islamic world. We should see a corresponding freedom for Christians to practice their faith in the Islamic world, as Muslims expect in the Western, world that comes from the Christian tradition.
Mm. In part three of the book, Where Do We Go From Here? That call to our own behavior, how we act out in the world, he doesn't shirk from that when in the section Overdue Reforms comes up, where he tackles just about every area where people would have the church to conform to the culture and under quote-unquote reform, whether it's in women's ordination or in the area of celibacy or homosexuality. He takes on these questions and does so with a lot of pastoral care, but is pretty firm.
Yeah, absolutely. He's pretty clear. I mean, I think he's firm in the sense that he's clear that there are things that aren't going to change. We can mm-hmm. talk and try to help people understand the church's position on these matters, but we're not going to see the ordination of women. The church is not going to say that homosexual activity is morally acceptable. The church is simply that these things are matters of fidelity to the church's core identity, which is rooted in Jesus Christ. This is not, these are not things that flow from sort of merely human ideas about how to arrange, community of disciples of Jesus, or human ideas about, how do we apply Jesus' teaching today. These are things that, the Catholic Church regards as coming to us from Jesus Christ. And so in order for us to be true to who we are as Christians, as followers of Christ, and as Catholics, that is to say, people who accept the totality, the whole of the message of Christ, these are things that we can't give on, and we can't compromise. At the same time, he does what I think is a pretty good job of presenting hard sayings in a way that has a certain kind of appeal. He doesn't just say, this mm-hmm. is it, tough, take it or leave it.
Mm-hmm.
But he tries to explain and make it clear to people that this is why the church says what she says, and not simply that the church says this. By the way, he doesn't use this expression, but years ago I worked in the Diocese of San Diego, and Bishop Brahm had an expression that summarized, I think, very well sort of the Pope's attitude on and that is that the church doesn't teach what she... These things are not true simply because the church teaches them, but the church teaches them because they're true.
Mm.
And because they're true, these are not things that the church can give on. They don't change. It's not as if the church is free to just change these things.
this particular book is a great one to for any Catholic out there to have, to get to know the Holy Father, to get to know this wonderful pastor we've been gifted with, but also as a gift to someone coming into the church so that they can understand this tremendous gift we have in the papacy and in the person who fills the shoes of St. Peter, not just the quote-unquote, he's the Pope, but here's the person the Holy Spirit has selected. And this book does it beautifully. I'm just so thankful to Ignatius Press for making it available to everybody to pick up.
Well, thank you. We're happy to do so. I'd like to close with this wonderful quote in the very last chapter. Peter Sewald presents the following question. He says, according to the Gospel of John, Jesus says at a certain key point that what counts is the mission of the Father. He quotes, and I know that his mission is everlasting life. Is that the reason why Jesus came into the world? And here's the Holy Father's answer. Certainly. That is the important thing, that we become capable of God and so are enabled to enter into eternal life. Yes, he came so that we might come to know the truth, so that we might touch God, so that the door might be open, so that we might find life, real life, that is no longer subject to death. And really, that is the message of the gospel. That's why Jesus came. That's why the Father sent him. God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believes in him shall not perish but have everlasting life. And the Holy Father really ends the book on that note, that it is the mission of Jesus to bring life, and that's really the mission of the church, is to communicate the life-giving message, the life-giving power, the life-giving reality of Jesus Christ. And that's why the book is called Light of the World, because Jesus himself is the light of the world, and the Holy Father's job is to be the principal witness, or one of the principal witnesses to Jesus as the light of the world. And in that way, we, the church, become the light of the world, as Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount.
Well, he may not consider himself a mystic boy, but he sure sounds and writes like one. Wonderful. Thank you so much, Mark Brumley.
You're welcome.
With Mark Brumley, we've gone inside the pages of The Light of the World, The Pope, The Church, and The Signs of the Times. To learn more about this book or to obtain a copy, go to Ignatius.com, the website for Ignatius Press. Or you can find it at any fine Catholic bookstore. To hear and download this episode along with many others, go to www.insidethepages.com. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Join me next time for Inside the Pages, insight from today's most compelling author.